Sharon, we're delighted that you're here tonight. We're really looking forward to this immensely. Let's welcome Sharon James.
Thank you, Martin. Good evening, everyone. It's great to be here tonight. Now, some of you may remember in 1970, this particular book hit the bookshops, including Heffer's down the road, and became a worldwide publishing sensation. Yes, it's The Female Eunuch. The Guardian described it, if I can read the small print, as a detailed exposition of chilling clarity that guarantees a cosmic persecution complex to any woman reading it. There you go. But actually, sexual liberation was the main theme of this book. Having been raised as a Roman Catholic, Germaine Greer had lost faith during her first year at university, and she wrote, "One of the sources of conflict was the collapse of my Catholic faith and my unwilling arrival at the conclusion that there was no God. Once that had been decided, there were no rules about anything else either." And so this book was a witty, bawdy, cheerful call to women everywhere to join Germaine in throwing out the rules. Marriage, of course, is the central way in which men have suppressed women through history. And so Greer advised, if women are to effect a significant amelioration in their condition, it is obvious that they must refuse to marry. No worker can be signed on for life. The title, of course, The Female Eunuch, alluded to Greer's argument that women are basically men who have been emasculated or made eunuchs by societal expectation. Men have managed, of course, to reshape the women the way they want them to be. Fashion, the need to attract men, all of that causes women to look different from men. It's not actually natural at all. All can be blamed on high-heeled shoes, the way that men take more exercise, and the desire of men for cuddly and hair-free women. Femininity is just an artificial construct, the result of patriarchy. Now, 30 years later, Greer admitted that the feminist revolution had not actually delivered success. And so in The Whole Woman, she wrote, "On every side, we see women exhausted, mutilated, lonely, guilty, mocked. As more and more women work outside the home, as more and more women walk out of oppressive marriages, we might expect the quantum of female malaise to diminish. The evidence seems to be that it's getting worse. 30 years ago, we heard nothing of panic attacks or anorexia or self-mutilation. Now, the icons of female suffering are all around us. So what went wrong? Has feminism not gone far enough? Has it gone too far? What is feminism anyway? This evening, we'll consider briefly the so-called first stage of feminism, the struggle for equal opportunities. We'll then move on to consider what's sometimes been described as gender feminism, the struggle for equal outcomes. I'm going to outline four areas in which I believe that the outworkings of gender feminism have been inimical to the well-being of many women. And as our time is very short, for those four headings, I've actually just outlined some free online resources on your handout so you can go away and explore some of those issues further if you want. But first of all, equity feminism. What is feminism anyway? Well, many people would understand feminism to be a movement for the rights of women, whether economic, political, educational, or social. And so in the broader sense, you could just say, well, isn't it just the effort to make life better for women? Those in the past who've campaigned for rights such as education and employment have often been retrospectively described as feminist. Now, this is actually somewhat misleading because it's all too easy to then assume that those people who fought for the end of discrimination shared the assumptions of 20th century feminists, which was very far from the case. As a sort of parallel anachronism, you could think of the way that some people might describe the Old Testament characters, Abraham and King David, as Christians, with all of the baggage of the New Testament that carries with it. You can understand why they do that, but a slight anachronism. But anyway, for a history of what you could call the proto-feminists, those men and women who campaigned for education, the suffrage, and an end to property and social injustices, I would actually recommend Kirsten Burkitt's book, The Essence of Feminism, and Melanie Phillips' book, The Ascent of Women. But accepting that terminology with that proviso, the first stage of feminist agitation, sometimes described as equity feminism, fought for the end to legal discrimination against women. But it was still assumed that women would often follow different life paths, particularly if they were wives and mothers. And indeed, the campaign for the so-called living wage or family wage was very often one of the planks of proto-feminist agitation. Another aspect of proto-feminist agitation was the so-called purity campaign, calling for the end to the sexual double standard, calling for husbands and fathers to be faithful to their family responsibilities. Now, it's actually an interesting and wide-open historical question as to whether women's rights were achieved as a result of feminist agitation or despite it, and as a result of other wider social and economic aspects. But whatever the cause, by the mid-20th century, women in this country had the freedom to vote, to be educated, to own property, to divorce, to have property, to have custody of their own children, and to enter all areas of employment. Now, surely Christians should applaud every effort to raise the status and dignity of women. The creation account in Genesis describes God making man and woman equally in his own image and giving them both equally the so-called creation mandate to rule the earth on his behalf. So it reads, in the image of God he created him, male and female he created them. Then God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the beasts of the field, the birds of the air, and so forth. So male and female, he created them. There are essential differences. Both man and woman are, in a real sense, godlike, and their complementary strengths reflect aspects of God's nature in complementary and different ways. But God blessed them and said to them, there is more that unites man and woman than divides them. It's man and woman alone in the created order that bear the divine image and have responsibility to rule in partnership as God's representatives. Now, of course, moving on to Genesis 3, that original harmony was disrupted hideously by the entry of sin into the world. The curse pronounced on the woman in Genesis 3, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you, is not the way God intended his creation to be. And that horrible verse marks the commencement of the battle of the sexes. From that time on, men would use their greater physical strength very often, not to protect women, but to oppress them. And by Genesis 6, we actually read that the earth was filled with violence, and that for that reason, God's heart was filled with pain. Throughout history, the differences between men and women have often been grossly overemphasized and used to justify discrimination, segregation, lack of opportunity, forced marriages, wife-beating, rape, pornography, and sex trafficking. Feminists are rightly angry when women are oppressed, but I have to tell you that God is infinitely more angry. The life, death, and resurrection of Christ began the process of the rolling back or reversal of the curse of Genesis 3, and historically it could be argued that positively, as far as the dignity of women are concerned, the birth of Jesus is the most significant turning point in human history. At the time of his birth, male citizens in the Roman Empire, just to mention one or two examples, enjoyed the so-called patria potestas, which was the absolute right of life and death over their wife, their children, and their slaves. Female infants were routinely exposed and killed. Fathers routinely gave away their young daughters, 11, 12-year-olds, away as child brides. And with the spread of Christianity, each of those practices was outlawed. And then fast-forwarding through the centuries to the modern mission movement, wherever Christianity spread in the world, one of the first indicators of Christian influence was the campaign for the provision of education for girls as well as boys. It was Christian influence that led to the outlawing of the burning of widows in India in 1829, the banning of the binding of feet of girls in China in 1912. And in every country where Christianity has had an influence, they have opposed, for example, the practices of female clitoridectomy and the marriage of prepubescent girls. And so women in the West now enjoy equal opportunities, and that is a wonderful thing. But in those countries in the world where Christianity has had the least impact, the situation of women is worst. Just one example would be Thailand. Young girls there are routinely sold into sex slavery, and it's estimated that 20% of all Thai girls between the ages of 11 and 17 become involved at some point in prostitution. For a graphic overview of the repression still suffered by females in many countries, especially, I have to say, in those countries under Islamic law, I would recommend Half the Sky, How to Change the World by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wooden. This is a shocking and disturbing read, claiming, for example, that the sex traffic in the 21st century is greater than the transatlantic slave trade of the 19th century. And in the best tradition of equity feminism, this book argues that worldwide investment in female education is not only the way to raise the status of women, but it's actually probably a key to tackling much broader issues of injustice and poverty. So that's just a brief word about, if you want to call it classical feminism, equity feminism, liberal feminism, the broad desire for equal opportunities. We move on now to something very, very different. Some people call it gender feminism, some people call it radical feminism. But the term patriarchy or father rule was coined by the feminist writer Kate Millett in the late 1960s, and this became a convenient label to describe the societal dominance of men and the way that the power of men was regarded as pushing women into an inferior status. So Adrienne Rich wrote, "Patriarchy is the power of the fathers, a familial social ideological political system in which men determine what part women shall or shall not play, and in which the female is everywhere subsumed under the male." And yes, there is a direct attack on heterosexuality in that last phrase. Women would only be liberated with the overthrow of patriarchy. But while patriarchy became increasingly viewed as the cause of all of the injustices suffered by women, a deep divide was actually opening up among feminists themselves. The rallying cry for many was equality. These argued that the differences, so-called, between men and women were socially determined, constructed, and not essential. As Simone de Beauvoir famously said, "A woman is not born, but made. One is not born, but becomes a woman, forced into that role by society." But other feminists celebrated difference and aimed at valorising or celebrating female attributes, which they variously described as relational strengths, emotional strengths, communicative strengths, and so forth. But these contradictory strands gained ground concurrently, and by the 1980s, the equality faction had succeeded. Women were viewed as an oppressed class, and Western governments had virtually all adopted anti-discrimination policies. But the difference faction was winning too. Because whereas women's differences had previously been seen as a problem, they were now to be seen as a source of pride and confidence. Women were no longer to be regarded as the second sex. No, they were to be regarded as the first sex. And patriarchy is to be overthrown. A woman-centred universe is to be ushered in. Patriarchal thinking, it is argued, has permeated all of our academic institutions. And so a woman-centred philosophy is to replace it. And this is the aim of women's studies, a growth subject in many institutions of higher education. So feminism cannot now be viewed as a single movement or ideology. There are multiple feminisms, variously qualified. But this broad category of gender feminism is often used to refer to those who aren't content with equal opportunities, the chance to achieve whatever you want to achieve if you're a woman. They want equal outcomes, which is something profoundly different. The United Nations Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination was ratified without debate by the British Parliament in 1986. This insisted that as many women as possible must enter the paid workplace and ruled that unless 50% of each trade or profession is female, there must per se be discrimination going on. It was a radical feminist charter which ignored the life choices that many women make to be full-time mothers or work part-time, and it denied the different occupational preferences of many men and women. But gender feminism didn't just aim to get the maximum number of women into the workplace and therefore economically independent. It opposed the heterosexist norm of family life, which it argued kept women socially dependent. And so feminist sociologists Pamela Abbott and Claire Wallace explain, fundamental to the feminist case is the revelation that the family is neither natural nor universal. Familialism is an ideology that serves to subordinate women to the needs of men in capitalism. Feminists have revealed that what was seen as natural and inevitable was socially constructed and could therefore be challenged and changed. Similarly, in her book The Ties That Bind in 1984, Carol Smart called for a reform of the law in what she called a feminist direction. Quote, the idea of abolishing marriage may sound as attractive as the classical communist call to abolish the family, but such demands are probably as unpopular as they are unrealistic. It would be far more effective to undermine the social and legal need and support for the marriage contract. This could be achieved by withdrawing the privileges which are currently extended to the married heterosexual couple. Such a move would not entail any punitive sanctions, but would simply extend legal recognition to different types of households and relationships. And similarly, Susan Moller Okin argued in 1989 that social justice is impossible to achieve while traditional family life is the norm, because it's based on gender, which she describes as, quote, the deeply entrenched institutionalization of gender difference. Traditional family is bound up with that, and you can't have social justice at the same time. So she concludes, a just future would be one without gender. Increasingly, many academic feminists were driving down the track of demanding that men and women should be freed from all distinctive sex roles. Both men and women need to be liberated from the tyranny of binary sex distinctions, because that actually traps men as badly as it traps women. Both men and women need to be liberated from the assumption that heterosexuality is normal and normative. Gender and sexuality themselves are constructed rather than natural or essential. And so writers such as Judith Butler challenge the division of humanity into male and female as oppressive and fundamentalistic, and they argue for plastic sexuality. And so in 2006, an international group formulated the Yogyakarta principles. These laid out the application of international human rights law to the areas of sexual orientation and gender identity. Now, these principles have not yet been incorporated fully into international law, but they call for all rights of sexual expression and reproduction and family life to be applied equally to gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender people. Very popular on the American university lecture circuit is a person called Kate Bornstein, and she's written extensively about her own sex change, but she would now renounce gender identity altogether and neither self-identify as a woman or a man. Kate argues that the way to liberate women is to deconstruct gender. She writes, women couldn't be oppressed if there was no such thing as women. Doing away with gender is key to the doing away with patriarchy. Gender fluidity is the ability to freely and knowingly become one or many of a limitless number of genders for any length of time, at any rate of change. Gender fluidity recognises no borders or rules of gender. Desire to free women from the oppressive restraints of biological destiny contributed to this movement to promote gender fluidity. But it was also the logical outworking of two other movements. Firstly, sexual revolution, the idea that sexual fulfilment is a human right and that freedom from all traditional norms is necessary to fulfil that right. But secondly, it was the natural outworking of the extreme individualism that was characteristic of Western societies by the end of the 20th century. It's said that the most widely cited sociologist in the world is Anthony Giddens. I have no idea whether that is true or not. But Anthony Giddens was advisor on family matters to Prime Minister Tony Blair, and he exerted considerable influence on the policies executed by the Labour government from 1997 to 2010. And so in 1992, in his book called The Transformation of Intimacy, Anthony Giddens argued that it's no longer acceptable to imprison people in relationships which are hedged around by social or legal obligation. He argued in that book that a pure relationship is a relationship where a person is free to leave at any point. They should not be bound by promise or duty. Because as soon as obligation enters your relationship, it is compromised. It is no longer free, and it is no longer pure. In a democracy of the emotions, the old-fashioned institution of marriage is doomed, clearly, because promises stultify the relationship. Our ideal, says Giddens, is confluent relationships. We are free to stay, we're free to go. We're free to choose our sexuality, we're free to choose our gender, we're free to choose whether to reproduce or not, with or without a resident partner. Giddens argued that those old certainties of the traditional family, etc., came with much too high a price tag, especially the oppression of women. And he argued that sexual emancipation represents sexual democracy. In the way that we've fought for democracy in the political realm, we must have sexual democracy in the social and family realm. Now, this all sounds rather magnificent, doesn't it? The pure relationship? I think he meant it to sound magnificent. Confluent relationships, democracy of the emotions, gender equality. He certainly would argue that that's better than the old certainties. But we ask now, how has this actually worked out in practice? Well, over the last 15 years, I've travelled widely in this country and overseas speaking at a variety of women's events. And so, by necessity, along the way, I've met women from all walks of life and listened to countless stories from ordinary women. And listening to their stories, I've become absolutely convinced that the practical outworkings of radical feminist policies have been a disaster for many women. Firstly, gender feminism assumed that all women must achieve financial independence with a satisfying lifelong career, because economic dependence was viewed as the ultimate degradation. Staying at home to look after the children was viewed as the equivalent of being incarcerated in a comfortable concentration camp, and marriage was viewed as little better than legalised prostitution. And so government policies began to penalise one-earner families, because accepting that many families choose for the mother to focus on caring was said to institutionalise the demeaning of dependent wives. But to get the maximum number of women into the workplace clearly meant that the state had to step in and provide daycare. And so every extension of state-subsidised child daycare has pushed up the tax bill for the one-earner or one-earner-plus part-time-earner families, and made it more and more difficult for women to make the choice to stay at home with their children. The many women I've spoken to over the years do not generally want to put their children into daycare. Virtually all of them have wanted to be based at home in the early years of their children's lives. Some have been able to, some haven't been able to, but that's been their desire. This fits perfectly with the research done by Catherine Hakim of the London School of Economics. She has shown conclusively that Europe-wide, only 20% of women actually want to make career their lifelong priority, and that's absolutely fine for that 20%. Europe-wide, another 20% of women aim to make home, family, children their lifelong priority and never wish to go out to paid work. And the majority of women, the 60% somewhere in the middle, follow the typical pattern of wanting to juggle, maybe working for several years, taking time out when they have children, then going back to work part-time later on. Now, Catherine Hakim argues that the goal of getting 50-50 male-female shares in all political, social, important top jobs is just unrealistic, and it doesn't reflect the life preferences of many women. And she shows that the so-called glass ceiling is actually the natural outworking of different preferences and choices. But in the meantime, women who do focus on their families are often made to feel inadequate as worth is measured by financial independence. Now, I've just summarised her research in two or three sentences, but her book, Feminist Myths and Magic Medicine, is actually available free online, and I've given the link in your handout to that book. The result of radical feminism is that many women have been left feeling like failures if they're not equal earners with their partners. Marriage, home and children are still the central focus of the lives of many of the women I've met over the years, but society does not value their contribution with dignity or respect. I'm only a mum, you hear so many of them say. And so the psychologist and author Oliver James argues that the only beneficiaries of modern feminism have been a small proportion of career women. Other women, he argues, have suffered the stigma of failure. Women have been told they should succeed in career and motherhood at the same time, and all too often they've been burned out in the process of trying to do so. But secondly, the demand for equal outcomes has led to structural discrimination against stable relationships. Feminist pressure led to government policy actually withdrawing privileges from the married family. It was thought to be oppressive to women to institutionalise this dependence on men, and feminists condemned breadwinning as oppressive. But as Melanie Phillips writes, fathers classically expressed their feelings for their families through practical deeds of working and providing. That is why the attack on male breadwinning is so devastating for men. It's nothing less than an attack on the distinctive way the sex expresses some of its deepest feelings. Now, government policy has not just withdrawn privileges from married families. It actually disadvantages many couples, both married and cohabiting. Tax policies treat everybody as an individual, so there's no benefit to be gained by being either married or in a cohabiting relationship. And so the most heavily taxed families are one-earner families. Conversely, welfare and benefits are calculated per household. You lose out if you declare either marriage or a cohabiting partnership, because it's assumed that your partner should support you. And so to get maximum benefits, there's every incentive to conceal your partnership. Now, this makes for a toxic combination. The way that those fiscal and welfare policies mesh together means that three quarters of couples, whether they're married or cohabiting, earning a combined sum of up to about £46,000 a year, would be better off splitting up. Individuals in a partnership where they're both on the minimum income, or individuals in a partnership where they're both on benefits, they'd all be better off if they split up. Can't you see clearly this militates against stable couple formation and stable family life? It means that in Britain, there are hundreds of thousands of people so-called living apart, living together, concealing their partnerships. And to put it brutally, the people that I meet and minister to at the lower end of the income scale are making an irrational economic choice if they get married. Some will lose housing, some will lose benefits. And that's bad news for women. Generally, women long for security. It's bad news for children, who are less and less likely to live with their own natural parents, still less their own natural married parents. And it's no surprise, then, that in 2004, 42% of children in Britain were born outside of marriage. More than 2.5 million children today in Britain live in lone parent families, and 1.25 million in step families. A total of 3.75 million children living apart from one of their natural parents. Now, of course, I'm not denying that there is a wide range of economic and cultural factors which also contribute to the changing shape of family. The collapse of traditional industries, for example, has been a significant contributing cause. Women are often better off financially on their own rather than in partnership with an unemployed male or a lowly paid male. But government policies have consistently made marriage a less and less feasible option for those in the lower income brackets. Patricia Morgan documents these policies, going so far as to say that the state has effectively waged war on the married family. And her book, The War Between the Family and the State, is also freely available online, and I've given the link on the handout. Thirdly, the demand for sexual freedom has led to greater unhappiness for women. Radical feminism was bound up with the sexual revolution. In the interests of equality, women should be as free as men to engage in sexual activity without the consequence of pregnancy. Hence the importance of contraceptive provision. Sexual fulfilment and reproductive liberty are now defined as fundamental human rights. And so young people are told to rely on their feelings as to when and whether to engage in sexual activity. Now, many years of working with women have persuaded me that the result of this has been disastrous. Countless women regret early sexual activities. They worry about STDs. They feel remorse about having had abortions. And they resent the fact that they're bringing up their children alone, with little contribution from the children's father or fathers. Anthony Giddens speaks in such lofty tones of the pure relationship. But for many women, this means simply that you never know when you wake up in the morning whether your partner will still actually be there. He's free. He's free to go off at any time with someone younger, prettier, cleverer, richer, or just somebody new. The price tag of the sexual revolution has been endemic insecurity. And I believe that teenagers have paid a particularly high price. Over the past number of years, several leading female doctors have come forward to denounce the value-free sex education that effectively gives young teenagers the green light to commence sexual activity. And so on the handout, I've just mentioned the website of one of them, the website of Miriam Grossman, who for 20 years was a university campus doctor in America. And she outlines many of the shortcomings of the different ways that we teach our young girls about sex. And I'm just going to mention some of these aspects. Firstly, young girls are not warned that physical intimacy promotes attachment and trust. Physical intimacy, even short of intercourse, actually floods the female brain with oxytocin, which plays a major part in the biochemistry of attachment. Girls are prone to develop deep feelings for a person who has absolutely no intention very often of bonding with them, and they're left feeling used and violated and betrayed. Girls expect emotional attachment at least twice as often as men, and after a sexual encounter, it's estimated about 91% of them feel remorse, regret, wish it had never happened. Girls cannot easily separate emotional and physical closeness. But if they demand more from a relationship, they're accused of being neurotic, demanding, and intense. If they're distressed when a relationship breaks up, they're told they're too sensitive. And as Wendy Shalit shows in her book, A Return to Modesty, they're just then routinely put on medication. Another female doctor who's written on this subject is Mary Piper, and her book, Reviving Ophelia, is on the book list. Over the years, Mary Piper has dealt with many causes of self-harm among young women, and she has come to the conclusion that one factor is the depression and self-hatred that follows when girls feel the pressure to lose their virginity. She mentions many girls, but one girl she describes is 17-year-old Tammy. Her mum found her cutting her breasts, and it turned out that she was miserable because her boyfriend was putting pressure on her not only to engage in sexual activity, but also to watch pornography. Conversely, Mary Piper, she's not a Christian, but she just says freely that the most well-adjusted girls among her clients are the parents with strict religious backgrounds who actually draw boundaries for them, giving them reasons to say no. And I think the most pitiful comment came from a girl who just couldn't understand why her mum kept leaving her alone in the house with her boyfriend because she was running out of excuses not to have sex with him. But then young girls are not warned that their bodies are not ready for sexual intimacy. It's not just their minds, it's their bodies. The cervix of teenage girls is very much more vulnerable to infection than that of a mature woman. The teenage cervix has a vulnerable area just one cell thick, and it's easy for HPV to settle there. By maturity, that area is much, much thicker and tougher and less prone to infection. And so completely aside from any moral reasons, for purely medical reasons, girls should be told to delay intercourse. Even though girls are now routinely given a vaccination against HPV, they're still vulnerable to other infections as well as non-covered strains of HPV. And then young girls are not warned that condoms do not provide reliable protection against either STDs or pregnancy. The failure rate in teenagers is high. And they're not often warned that STDs can cause infertility later on. They're not clearly warned very often that abortions not only carry significant risks of emotional damage, but also potential risks to the viability of future pregnancies. And then I think it's very sad that very often young girls are not warned that their fertility is a window of opportunity that may close sooner than they expect. I did spend some time as a school's careers advisor, and all of the emphasis now is on pushing girls to fulfill their career ambition. But it's a no-no to warn girls that if they do want to have a family, as the majority of them say they do, it would be wiser to allow time for that sooner rather than leaving it into their late 30s and 40s. It's easiest for a woman to conceive a healthy baby when she's in her 20s. But about 90% of young women really believe that they'll be able to get pregnant into their 40s without much difficulty at all. Pastorally, in women's ministries, infertility is one of the most painful and sensitive and heartbreaking issues I've had to deal with, and young women are simply not being told the facts. Fourthly, and much more briefly, family fragmentation has left women and children more vulnerable to abuse and violence. Of course, and rightly, a central concern for most feminists is violence against women. But the collapse of marriage in low-income areas has led to an increase of rates of violence against women and children. Robert Whelan's research has demonstrated that children living with unmarried biological parents are 20 times more likely to be victims of abuse than those living with their married biological parents. Those living with their mother and a boyfriend, other than the father, are 33 times more likely to be victims of abuse. If you'd like details of his work, there's an article that can be downloaded that I've put the link on the web, on the handout as well. Now, of course, there are stable and committed cohabiting couples who are excellent parents, but the evidence is indisputable that overall, the married family is the safest place for children to be. Anthony Daniels worked for many years in both a hospital and a prison in Birmingham, and over those years he treated thousands of criminal perpetrators and their victims. He came to be convinced that the shocking levels of violence in society against men, women and children, but particularly against children, were a direct outworking of sexual revolution and the breakdown of stable relationships. A lot of his writing, which was usually published under the pseudonym of Theodore Dalrymple, is available online, and on the handout I've given links to two of his essays dealing with this theme, but I'll just give one short quote. He writes, "If anyone wants to see what sexual relations are like, freed of contractual and social obligations, let him look at the chaos of the personal lives of members of the underclass. Here are children who have children, women abandoned by the father of their child a month before or a month after delivery, insensate jealousy, the reverse of the coin of general promiscuity that results in the most hideous oppression and violence, serial stepfatherhood that leads to sexual and physical abuse of children on a mass scale, and every kind of loosening of the distinction between the sexually permissible and the impermissible." And so to go back to Anthony Giddens, the family advisor to Tony Blair, he described liberated and shifting relationships as confluent relationships. But anyone who's engaged firsthand in pastoral work in some of Britain's most deprived areas is much more likely to describe them as chaotic relationships. And so in conclusion, gender feminism actually failed to respect and affirm the central concerns of multitudes of ordinary women. Financial independence and career success has been assumed to be the sum total of the ambition of all women. This is true for some, but by no means for all. The life choices of those who value marriage, home, and motherhood have been disrespected. Feminist pressure has led to a demand for equal outcomes in the workplace. The genuine life choices of many women have thereby been undermined. Germaine Greer herself rails against the fight for what she calls spurious equality in the whole woman. She describes spurious equality as trying to join the masculine elite on its own terms. Feminist pressure led to government policies which actually discriminate against marriage or even cohabitation, as it was seen to be so important to liberate women from being dependent on a partner. This too has undermined the genuine life choices of many people. And then radical feminists demanded complete sexual freedom. And now Germaine Greer herself admits the disaster that this has been for women. Young women, she rages, now have a duty to say yes, whatever their partners may desire. They're enslaved by the penetration culture. And so total sexual freedom, I would argue, has offered women an almost infinite variety of ways in which to get hurt, an ever-increasing risk of disease, and for many, ongoing feelings of guilt and regret. And total individualism in relationships has only offered total insecurity. By contrast, Christianity offers really good news for both women and men. The message is that every individual is to be afforded dignity, meaning, and worth, whether or not they're financially independent, whether or not they have a successful family life. Dignity does not depend on external measures of success. The world around us today is very cruel in its judgments, and perhaps especially so for females who are so often judged on appearance and then expected to have work and family success all at the same time. Women are expected to have it all and do it all. But Jesus Christ himself treated every woman he encountered with respect, and his followers are called on to do the same. And he held out the free offer of grace, forgiveness, and a new start to men and women alike. In contrast to the sexual revolution, the biblical recipe for human fulfillment is that we are to live within our Creator's boundaries if we want to know real happiness. We're not free to behave how we want in this world. We're ultimately answerable to the one who made us. And he will demand an accounting for every act of oppression, wrongful discrimination, violence, or cruelty against every human being made in his image. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Sharon. Some really thought-provoking and sobering stuff. We now have a period of questions. And there is a roving mic so that we can hear what you need to say. There's a lot of kind of controversial stuff that Sharon's been saying. And that might annoy you, or it might thrill you. But if you can kind of keep your comments to, or put them in the form of a question, I think that would be helpful. It can be a really punchy question, but if please, a question rather than a speech. Okay, you're
done. Thank you. I don't know where to start. There's so much I could say. Your talk started by proposing the split in the feminist approach. I wonder which side you think is winning now, given and which side you might be associated with, because obviously you cover pro and anti points. Speaking as a man and as a masculinist, I'm very much a campaigner for equal rights, equal opportunity for men and women. And I started for campaigning for equal opportunities for women in the 70s, but obviously now that women have got far more than equal opportunity, I'm now campaigning for equal opportunity for men. I'm treated as an extremist because it's so widely accepted that women dominate just about everything and everywhere. And it's very damaging, particularly for children, that this should be seen.
If you can get to your question, please.
Yeah. What I'm saying is then, given the nature of the undermining of the family that you mentioned with government policies under Tony Blair, which unfortunately have been continued under the Conservatives, would you now support the men's movement in campaigning for equal rights for children to see their fathers, for sharing the benefits and an ending of the winner-takes-all system, which, as well as trapping women in childcare, has also prevented men providing an equal opportunity to look after children, which the evidence so overwhelmingly needs, because children need both parents, not just one.
Yes, I have great sympathy for that, and I've looked at the Fathers for Justice and other men's movements and fathers' sites, and I accept that very often there have been injustices done. I think there's a lot of injustice in the way the divorce law operates. I mean, a very blatant example of an injustice would be if a woman has an affair, goes off with another man. In some cases, she's given the house and the children, but all of the fault is on her side, and there's no recognition of that in the legal system. So, yes, I fully accept that there are definite injustices, but I would also say there are so many levels and tissues of injustice in the way that family law operates. I find it difficult I'm not an expert on the men's movement or the father's movement, but I hear what you're saying and I have a great deal of sympathy.
With a blue t-shirt, yeah.
Hello, one of the areas that I've been really interested in on the whole gender debate is how prize money has been awarded in the sporting world. You know, and it's really, really interesting sort of seeing how the prize money of Wimbledon is now kind of equal prize money, but different numbers of sets. Like I can kind of see different groups getting upset over different things about that. I was just wondering if you had anything to say about that.
I regret to say that I don't watch Wimbledon. It seems to be grossly unfair that you get paid the same for three sets as five sets. Yeah, that seems to be an example of banging the equality drum with perhaps a great deal of justification, but yeah, I hear what you're saying there.
I'm not trying to make a point out of what I'm wondering is, it's interesting your comment about Jermaine Greer saying she didn't think it was good for women to kind of be trying to join the
Exactly. Exactly.
Because in sport, the separation of the seems to be still there in pretty much any sport. I think that's quite an interesting application of it.
Because there are so clearly different physical differences between men and women and tend to be better and worse at some sports. And I see it as no liberation at all to put the young girls out into prize fighting. Not that I'm that keen on prize fighting for men either, but the idea of putting young girls out as prize fighters seems to me to be outrageous. But yeah.
Okay, is anyone here who's sort of felt upset by anything that Sharon has said and disagrees and feels, look, I really want to ask a question? But I'm not quite sure if I should, because I'm in a church and people might disagree with me. But I mean, you know, here is your chance, I'm telling you, right now. Otherwise, we're all true believers, are we? Yeah, thank you. Just have you wait for the mic. Thanks.
You did talk about how some people think that the government's waging the war on the family. Do you not think it could be seen as the government lifestyles in a changing society, maybe?
If it was a level playing field, that would be absolutely hunky-dory. That'd be fine. But the trouble is, it's not a level playing field. So when you have three-quarters of couples up to the combined income of £46,000 being disadvantaged for being together, that goes way beyond accommodating different lifestyle choices. It's actually putting roadblocks in the way to stable couple formation. I mean, I haven't been able to document that fully, and that's why I've given the link through to Patricia Morgan's book, The War Between the State and the Family, because she not only gives a lot of evidence, but then would footnote further evidence. And it's worth looking at. You might not come away agreeing with it, but the rhetoric has been over the years that the government is just completely neutral, even-handed, and wants freedom for people to live in whatever way they want. And that sounds great, but it's not actually neutral and it's not even-handed. There is a disadvantage to couple formation.
Do you want to come back? Are you okay?
Sorry, thanks for the other speech, it's really interesting. You talked about how, one thing I want to talk about that I haven't remembered is about young girls and sex and sexuality. And obviously, we've gone through it four years ago having sex education. The kind of physical and mental attributes. But for me, and having a lot of my friends, they feel exactly the same. I don't really put it down to just perhaps feminism, but the fact of a cultural thing.
Yeah.
Perhaps, I mean, how do you feel about culturally? This is just something that's progressing. Maybe it's just now more open air, perhaps people just more want to talk about it, whereas before, maybe 50, 60 years ago, sex was just something you didn't talk about, and maybe the feelings were still there.
No, the sexual revolution as such was an ideology that was gaining ground from the 1950s onwards, and it had its genesis with people like Kinsey in the States, Wardle B. Pomeroy in the States. And Kinsey's book in particular was the catalyst, because in that book he basically purported to present neutral surveys which purported to show that the abnormal was normal. I won't go into too many details. Feel free to read it if you dare. The research was flawed. Kinsey was very dysfunctional, seriously damaged, seriously disturbed. The kind of experiments that he did would now be classed as child abuse, because a lot of them involved children and sex. But the philosophy that came out of it was that children should be allowed free sexual expression from infancy onwards.
Sorry, can we have the mic? Yeah.
But those feelings and how women feel left, you know, when they may feel betrayed and things like that, insecure. Yes. What I'm saying is, because sex is now very open, we talked about seeing women and men express these emotions, And that's actually not a new thing.
Oh, totally. No, it's not a new revelation, and women and men can equally feel betrayed or vulnerable or abused if a relationship ends. But what I'm trying to argue is that in the past, there's been an assumption that sexual activity should ideally go with a committed relationship. The sexual revolution actually threw that norm away and said, no, sexual activity is more or less a physical function that is not necessarily associated with a long-term, let alone exclusive relationship. It's just fun. And the philosophy went further than that and said that if you repress sexual activity and sexual fulfillment in children and young people, as well as adults, this will lead to psychological disturbances and even crime. So they would look at criminals and say the reason was these people are criminals is because they were sexually repressed as children. Right. Now, I've got at home two very interesting little books by Wardle Pomeroy, who is Kinsey's associate, one called Girls and Sex, one called Boys and Sex, published by Penguin in this country in 1970 and 1971, and these were promoted by the Family Planning Association. And these books were basically saying that we should encourage children to play sex, have sexual activity with each other, whether girls or boys or both, from a very early age. Now, these books wouldn't be allowed. I mean, these books would not be allowed now. It's just kind of so outrageous because of our fears of child abuse, etc., etc. But this was the thinking around the 60s and 70s, and it led to a very, not just permissive, but you would call a culture that was encouraging young people into sexual activity. And I suppose dealing partially with the fallout of these people who are now in their 40s and 50s, you see that this encouraging of sexual activity divorced from committed relationships was socially, emotionally, and physically a disaster for many people. And though that sort of philosophy, although the children bit's left out now because of the sensibilities we have about child abuse, but that philosophy is still applied to teenagers. I have an 18-year-old daughter, so I hear all about what she gets in sex ed and all about the fact that all of the girls in her class are on the pill, even though they're not having sex because the doctors just sling them on the pill anyway as a precaution, so-called. And the attitude among many is still they're going to be much happier if they just get on with it.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I was listening to an interesting lady, Kate Banya. I don't know if you know her. She's written a book called it's Gender Illusion or something like that in Oxford last year. And one of the things she was saying is she's a feminist, but she was saying that actually there's a we need to kind of get beyond the battle of the sexes conversation and actually work together as genders. So she actually says part of the answer is a new breed of man. So in the kind of words of maybe a spin on, seeing as we're in this place, the Schaefer title, how should men now live?
I think that in the past, I just hinted at the fact that the differences between women and men have been grossly overemphasized. And so, sadly, when you look at the history of the Christian church, the church has not been immune to that, and very often women have been put in a box and treated as second-class citizens, and their gifts and abilities have not been encouraged and used, all of that. I think that perhaps culturally, in the past, men have been themselves imprisoned in certain quite rigid stereotypes and perhaps not encouraged to be engaged in hands-on childcare, etc., etc., etc. So I think that culturally there's all sorts of movement, and some of it is positive as well as negative. In any cultural movement, you can denounce the bad bits, but there's generally positive movement as well. And as I look at the families that I minister to and with, there are great examples of fatherhood and motherhood, wives and husbands, actually cooperating together in a way that maybe wasn't always the case 60 years ago, and that's all good. And there is some good stuff around for men, a sort of much more modified British restrained version of the men's movement you get in America, but there is some good stuff about taking responsibility, about taking a lead in the home, not just being passive and abdicating everything to your wife to do, because very often she's well organised and sitting back and hiding behind the newspaper. There are some good resources around for men now, and yes, it's great when you see them picking up and running with that.
Just over there, yeah.
Good evening. I've heard that many organisations in Europe and all over the world are approaching, they're trying to get 50% ratio. But one is that the fight against the discrimination of women in the workplaces will lead to discrimination of men. It's not balanced, so to say.
Sorry, so what's your question, please?
The fight against discrimination of women in organisations to get places, to get work jobs, is there a possibility that it will eventually lead to a discrimination of men?
Yeah, in the same way as race quotas can lead to discrimination against certain racial groups. Yes, I think so. I think that I would recommend that link through to that book on 12 feminist myths in Feminist Myths and Magic Medicine, because Catherine Hackham is not a Christian, she's not got a religious or a ideological drum to beat in any way, but she's looking at preference theory. She's an economist who looks at preference theory. And she says, the minute you introduce quotas, you're actually doing a disservice to the people you're trying to help. Because once you've got that job, how do I know that I've not just got that job because I'm a woman? I mean, how insulting is that? So quotas, affirmative action, in the States have generally had a fairly serious effect on racial relations, not always a positive effect at all. And quotas in terms of gender don't have positive outcomes necessarily for women. And yes, I can see them, and perhaps in my experience have already seen them having negative outcomes for men. And I suppose in that sense, economically, I'd be much more tempted to say, well, safer to be a libertarian and let market forces take their place and let quality win the work position rather than some false idea of quotas. I do see the possibility of mending being discriminated against, yes.
Since I'm standing up here, I'm going to take the chance of asking you a question myself, Sharon. You said at the beginning, in relation to gender feminism, that they were saying that the kind of more traditional view of men and women's relationships was just a construct, just a social construct, which was oppressive. Do they see their own view as a kind of construct? And in what senses is it supposed to be more liberating? In what way does Giddings, for example, see himself as actually being more liberating? What value system? What kind of is it just pure autonomy? Is that what they're sort of...
Freedom really is the bottom line. I think that Giddens would freely admit that his utopia of confident relationships, pure relationships, etc., has a downside. He says it's insecure, but he says freedom is so much the trump card with which you have to operate. It's worth it, freedom.
But, I mean, interestingly, you see, you used to... you see a sort of convergence between the economic right who want to have freedom and the cultural left who want to have freedom. So everyone's kind of committed to complete freedom. But it seems to be, in a sense, a freedom that benefits the elite, particularly in this case, because elite women are doing fine. I mean, they're really sort of, hitting all the high spots. And yet it seems to be the people lower down the social scale who seem to be actually suffering. Is that the case? I mean...
That
can't
is
we make that charge?
That is absolutely the case, and Theodore Durham has been making that case for 20 years. Okay. And I think his books are absolutely superb. Life at the Bottom argues that the ideas of sexual revolution were put forward by a very, very privileged elite, and they could afford to do what they want and live how they want, and it had very little practical outworking in their life. So when those ideas filter down into the kind of people he's dealing with in the slums of Birmingham, it is absolutely catastrophic because there are no safeguards. And he says the outworking for poor people is shameful and the elite have got a lot to answer for. In my case, I simply would register that I really resent it when I see politicians, whether they be Tony Blair and his lovely family, or David Cameron and his lovely family, or Gordon Brown and his lovely family, talking about marriage and family life. And well, you can afford it. You can afford to be married and have children. But your policies mean that the people I'm dealing with at such a level, such a level, such a level, there's no chance they'll ever be able to marry, form a stable relationship, have children, because you've actually ripped all of that away from them. And it's very hypocritical to talk about commitment to family when you're rich, when you don't allow it to the people who are poor.
And this is mostly people who see themselves on the liberal left, who are supposed to be concerned for the poor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Polly, yeah. We can have it.
So I'm fairly new to the subject, so can you explain, for me I see that there's a huge connection between the feminist view of the woman and some sort of assumption about what a human being is. So how, when the feminists started their movement, were they particularly influenced by a view of human being or a view of
I think this is a question about the philosophy of feminism, and I think that the starting point of the philosophy of feminism is oneself, one's own experience. And so as a woman, if I feel that I am being disadvantaged or oppressed or whatever, my experience will determine my place in the world and how I react to it. And generally, philosophically, the enemy would very often be any external definition of my identity, because I'm free to construct my own identity. And that's where, if you like, the key crunch point of radical feminism and Christianity comes up, because Christianity would say God defines my identity as a human being, and a gender feminist would say I define my identity as a female. So philosophically, that would be the touch point, I think, the conflict point.
When you deal with real people, how do you go on to introduce that alternative view of human beings? Yeah.
Well, I think that, if you like, dealing with real human beings, somebody will say to me, I do quite a lot of door-to-door visiting, so conversations arise. Somebody will say to me, how can God allow suffering? First key point. Why do you care so much about suffering? So this guy will come up with some story of child abuse or whatever. Why do you care? You care because you've got a conscience. You're fundamentally a very good person. You care because you're good, you've got a conscience. Who put that conscience there? If it's just survival of the fittest, why should you care? Why would it matter? Somebody's given you that. Who's given that to you? I believe God's given that to you. I believe that you're made in the image of God, like God, in that you've got a conscience. You know the difference between right and wrong, and that's outside of yourself. It's been given to you. So that's where I would start.
Great. Randall?
Yes.
He's coming.
Yeah, sharing the questions that have just preceded mine, point out how long the discussion really is, because it really is Rousseau, isn't it? And the concept of freedom, being independent of any authority above myself. And so that being the case, to what degree, I mean, I just found it fascinating all that you said about the details, you know, how the feminism moves against. To what degree is the philosophy really the problem? I think the philosophy that lies behind is that there is no God, we're just here, and so we make up our rules and so on. So there is a construct at the end. How would you see that?
Yeah, I'd say that absolutely it's the philosophy that lies behind it that is the thing to address. Because if we're not answerable to anyone outside of ourselves and we can make up our own rules, you get now the demands to legalise incest. It's not called incest anymore. There's some other fancy name that sounds great. You get demands to legalise multiple relationships. It's already legal in the Netherlands to have marriages of three. You get demands to legalise bestiality. There are some demanding that in the States. And you get strong and insistent demands to legalise paedophilia, which is no longer called that. There's some other intergenerational sex. Because basically the argument is that if I'm free to fulfil myself and I'm not answerable to anyone outside of myself, viz. God, I must be free to fulfil whatever orientation I have. And to fulfil your sexual orientation is now defined as a human right. The Cairo Declaration of 1994 says that all human beings have rights to sexual freedom and reproductive freedom. So, as long as I can define what I want to do as an orientation, which is outside of my control, because clearly an orientation is something that has just been dumped on me by my genes or whatever, I can argue that I've got a right to do that thing. Obviously, the slight fly in the ointment is it should be consensual with whatever, whoever, whichever. But basically, I should be allowed, if I can secure the consent, to do whatever. So everything goes now. Yeah.
Sorry, you wanted one? Yeah.
If I understand it right, you would think that the right way of living moral life is Christianity. So the way we can understand right or wrong. But when I look at the figures of people who attend church in the UK, it's really going down, and most of the young people who you say, for example, have early sex, they don't really attend church, and I don't know if they believe God from believing God or not. So maybe for young people there must be some other belief system which can lead them, I mean not feminism, but other belief systems which can say don't have sex or be good,
yeah.
This kind of thing. So what do you think this moral system can be?
Yeah, that's a very good question, thank you very much. Because I'm a Christian, I believe that Christianity is, if you like, the life system that offers the good life, the happiest way to live. But also because I'm a Christian, I believe that God has made every human being, whether they're a Christian or not, by definition he's made every human being, and he's given every human being a conscience. And so that's where I think that you don't necessarily have to go out and campaign for Christianity to be legalised, which would clearly be impossible in a situation where, as you say, we have declining church attendance and a low number of professing Christians. But what I would say is that because Christians have a clear conviction as to the best way to live, because they believe that we have access to the Maker's instructions, we would expect those Maker's instructions to actually ring a bell with other human beings who don't necessarily accept the fact that God made them. But because they've got a conscience, you could argue that actually people do best when they're in long-term, committed, stable relationships with an obligation to protect that relationship from one person betraying the other. Children do best when they're in a relationship with their own natural parents who have a very high interest in investing in them and securing their well-being in their future. There is no better way to bring up the future generation. And so on what some people would call natural law arguments, or what I would call arguments that you could appeal to the conscience with, I think that it's possible to say that this freewheeling, complete individualism, which has been sold to us for the last number of years, has been demonstrated to be a failure, and it would be better to go back to a social system that supported stable relationships, and you could call it marriage, because actually that is the best possible way humans have come up with for protecting family life. And you wouldn't be basing it overtly actually on the Bible at all. You'd be basing it on the common ground that you have with people who have a conscience. Does that answer your question at all?
Well, I wondered, were you asking whether in the light of the weakness of Christianity in this society, that there should be alternative ethical or religious systems that could perhaps take the place of Christianity? Was that your question, in a sense? That's what I heard.
I'm not a Christian, and yeah. I believe in God, but I don't have any religion. And but also I think that most of the teenagers, they don't really accept Christianity, because for me there are a lot of downturns. When you don't believe in a label of religion, there must be something which can lead you accept of religion.
I see.
So that's what I think, maybe there must be some other system. And also about marriage, I wanted to ask. If you say that the right way for a woman is to be married, but in reality, due to the fact that divorce now is legal, a lot of men can just leave you and go somewhere else. So working in a health career is like a safe.
Yes. Yes.
A safe place.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think that in today's world, it is self-interest and protection and sensible for any woman to have a career and to be able to support herself. I mean, forget the fact that your husband may walk out on you. He might drop dead tomorrow. You know, you actually need, in this day and age, to be able to support yourself. But equally, I think that it's helpful if society is friendly to the fact that very many women want to give up work while their children are young. And in some ways, there's been progress on employers, for example, accepting that after a woman has been out of the workplace for 20, 25 years, she might have important skills that she could transfer back into the workplace and to allow those mothers back into the workplace. It's very complex, the whole thing of employment law. In some areas, there's been quite unhelpful policies. In some areas, there have been very helpful policies. But I do think it's wise for every woman to have a career with which she can support herself.
Sorry, you. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, I was a bit puzzled after your talk because I was left with the impression that I wasn't sure whether you were actually giving your views or if you were quoting from a lot of other people. So, but it's sort of refreshing to hear you answer because you're obviously giving your views and impression and answers. Whereas it didn't sound like you were giving your views, perhaps, in the talk, I don't know.
No, in the talk I was really trying to just outline what two broad categories of feminists are thinking.
Yeah.
And I think it's fair when you're describing a viewpoint to describe it in their own words rather than to just come at it from a unsympathetic point of view. Because I think that the rule in courteous engagement is to let people speak for themselves. So in describing equity feminists and then gender feminists, I did try to let them speak for themselves. I would not identify as a feminist, I would identify as a Christian, but as a Christian who, because every human being is made in the image of God, would want every human being, whether they're male or female, to have dignity and respect and equal opportunities. I think the word feminist is so loaded now with other connotations, I perhaps would not generally use it, but if it was to be used purely in the sense of a desire for the well-being of women, then there wouldn't be a problem, but it generally has a lot more baggage than that. So my voice would be probably a Christian who is critical of feminism, but I think it's important to listen to what feminists are saying if you're quoting them to quote them in their own words and accurately. And I also think it's vitally important to listen to and speak to the pain that many feminists would have suffered. Not at all, because equally I would say that the sexual revolution has caused a massive fallout of pain for men.
Yeah.
I accept the fact that family fragmentation has damaged men. I alluded to the fact that the demonising of the breadwinning role has actually hurt men at the place where very often they found their deepest source of identity. And I would say that sexual revolution, radical feminism, has been a disaster for men and women alike. Thank you.
Is anyone who has not asked a question want to ask one? Yes, there.
Hi. What would you like to see the medical community contribute to this debate?
I'd like to see the medical community being honest about the risks of particularly early sexual activity, but also other sexual activities. I mean, I heard Dr. Miriam Grossman speak when she was over in the UK earlier this year, and she just had a string of horrors. She's American, but she came to London to speak earlier in the year. She just had a string of horror stories about how doctors in America had tried to get some sort of warning about certain sexual activities and the risks involved to young people, but they've been blocked by the health authorities. Now, I don't know how much that is the case here, but I do know from my experience as a governor of a school and as a teacher and as a parent that generally the so-called safe sex message is put over in a very deceptive way, because teachers in particular are just terrified, absolutely terrified, of comeback in terms of not having told people to wear condoms. And so they're so worried about that that they underplay the fact that engaging in sexual activity, even with a condom, is a very high-risk thing to do, and particularly certain activities. They underplay that because they're scared people think, oh, hang it, it's all so dangerous, I won't bother with a condom. And then they think they'll be in trouble. So the truth is not being told for that reason and for other reasons. And I would just like to see the medical community not following the politically correct path of saying sexual fulfilment is a human right for everybody from age 3 upwards, but saying sexual activity is a very, very, very high risk activity. It is more dangerous than smoking. It's more dangerous than being obese. It's more dangerous than not exercising. We're very strict about other things with young people. We should go back to being very, very strict about this. But the medical community at the moment is not prepared to do that.
Do you think there is space to... I mean, you mentioned about the fact that, you know, girls, well, they have a high affinity for feeling bonding after school intimacy, etc. Do you think there is space to say that kind of thing in schools?
I wish there was. I'm sure that there are some...
Do you think there actually is?
I think that some responsible teachers may hint at it, but the information is not clearly enough out there. I mean, Miriam Grossman has written a very nice little booklet for girls called Sex and Sensibility or some such thing, and she just outlines those points very, very clearly. But I've not seen... I've looked at a lot of sex education materials, both Christian and non-Christian, because a lot of Christians do work going into schools doing sex ed. And I've looked at a lot of sex ed materials, but I have not yet seen this side of the Atlantic anything that clearly enough lays out the risks. Now, Miriam Grossman's little booklet for girls is on the book list, and I would love to see that de-Americanized and pushed into schools here. But, yeah, that's what I'd like to see.
Right. Okay. You've got to give it to the people who are eager. A question, not a speech.
A question. Speech, yeah, thank you. I'm not a Christian. I'd like to come at this from a different point of view, if I may. Do you agree that feminism, the increase in feminism and success, particularly with the radical feminist wing, is directly responsible for the reduction in church usage and church attendance, and that feminism and Christianity are mutually exclusive? And the reason I say this is there has been a fall off in the number of men attending church, particularly. Some churches say 3/4 of the attendees are women. I wonder if this is also a factor. But also, there's a lot of women-only organisations within church, women-only breakfasts, women-only conferences. And how do you view this as being destructive on relationships, and particularly destructive on the chances of men engaging with the church? And what's your message to the church to engage in this feminist undermining of the family and the marriage and so on, which you've alluded to? And we're in a Christian environment here. I'm not a Christian, but what message do you want us to go back to our relative churches with and say, talk about this, don't wash it under the carpet, don't ignore it? What message to get men and women back together?
You make quite a number of points there that are valid. There's a valid point there about the feminization of religion, and that puts men off. And yes, men don't want to go to a church that is, as they perceive it, run by women and feminized, singing soppy songs about how much Jesus loves you, that are just about emoting and being soft. I mean, there's one issue there. There's an issue about the church, if you like, buying into the feminist culture. But I have to say to you that the churches that have bought into the extreme feminist culture of denying gender distinctions and pushing all aspects of sexual activity are generally the liberal churches, and they're collapsing in membership, not doing well at all. The more conservative churches, which hold to the biblical teaching that God made men and women as different and equal, distinct and equal, those are the churches where attendance is going up, and they're seeing growth. So the church that I belong to is growing fairly quickly. There are equal numbers of men and women. The men are very active, very strong, taking a lead. And there's not a sense of feminization, but there are some activities of women and men, but it's not a feminized church. So I would say that in as far as Christianity gives way to a very liberal agenda, it's not going to do well anyway, and it's going to die. Insofar as Christianity is upholding the truth that all human beings should be respected and men and women are equal and different, those churches actually aren't doing too badly. Maybe you should go along and try one.
Yeah. A conservative church. I think we better call it a day. We've had a nice long period of questions. Sharon, I can't thank you enough. It's been just really terrific in light of what one reads in the paper and the media, which is sort of controlled in many ways and is not sufficiently critical, to hear somebody give, in a sense, the other side in such a coherent and well-evidenced way. So thank you very much indeed, and let's give her a